From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, mass vaccination sites are open in Michigan's largest cities as the state tries to outrun a spike in COVID-19 cases.
It's still a bit confusing to navigate which system and where and how to schedule and all that, but the vaccines are out there, so we could really begin to see those results.
And we check in with public health officials from opposite sides of the state about the challenges of reaching herd immunity.
We know that we've got about 10 to 15% of the population that just is opposed, almost dogmatically opposed to vaccine. And they're probably not going to be persuaded.
Plus, the history of sea shanties as sung by black sailors on the Great Lakes.
A lot of the first black Michiganders actually came to settle in Michigan after working on these ships.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. It's a race against time for Michigan's public health officials as they try to balance combating a spike in COVID cases with the logistics of getting as many people vaccinated as possible. Today, we'll speak with health officials in two areas that have shot into double-digit infection rates.
Everybody I know knows somebody who's got COVID right now.
But first, let's talk about what it's like to be on the other side of that vaccination push. It feels like availability of COVID-19 vaccines have gone from hard to find to gettable with caveats within just a matter of weeks. We're joined now by two Michigan radio reporters who had occasion to visit mass vaccination sites over the past few days as they became eligible for their doses. Sarah Swick joins us from Detroit, and we're also talking today with Dustin Dwyer from Grand Rapids. Sarah, Dustin, welcome.
Hey.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Sarah, I believe you were down at Ford Field recently. What was it like there?
I was there this past Saturday for my first dose of the Pfizer vaccine, and it's quite an operation. I mean, I got in there. It all takes place on the concourse, so it's not like you get to go down on the field or anything like that, but got in there, filled out a form. That took, you know, a few minutes, and then I think I waited in line for maybe less than 5 minutes, and everything was very spaced and very, you know, it felt very safe. And then there are just sort of these little curtained off partitions set up around the concourse, and they send you down to a number. And a U.S. Air Force airman, who was actually a young woman from California, gave me my first dose. It was all very quick. Walked around the corner, sat in an observation area for about 15 minutes with a bunch of other folks, again, all pretty spaced out, just to make sure we didn't have any negative reactions, and there are medics on the scene in case you do. Then I walked out. The whole thing took about a half an hour.
Someone I know who lives in Detroit said that his experience there was that everything was very efficient, but he also mentioned that everyone was very kind. I mean, Detroit's been through a lot right now. I imagine that's not a small part of the trying to get the ethos right at the moment.
So, yes, everyone was very kind. It wasn't, I'm not going to lie, I didn't have a ton of interaction with the other folks who were there, mainly because everything was so physically spaced and sort of well controlled. But the group of folks who were administering the vaccine and were from all over the country, like I said, the young woman who administered mine was from California. There were definitely folks there from all over the country administering the vaccines. And I think another friend who got vaccinated there made the comment that it was the most well-behaved group of adults that they had seen in quite some time. So everything really, really went quite well, and everyone was quite gracious and well-behaved.
We'll take it. Dustin, tell us about where you went for your dose.
I went to the DeVos Place Convention Center, which is in downtown Grand Rapids. It is not as cool as Ford Field, I don't think, on the inside. It's just a big convention center. What's different about it now is that they have the entire space devoted to vaccinating people. So it's every room, the big halls. And the day I went, which was Monday, was the day when Spectrum Health said they vaccinated more than 12,000 people in a single day, which they think is the biggest one-day vaccination anywhere in the Midwest, certainly the biggest in Michigan for a one-day total. So I got to be one of those 12,000, and I actually didn't have to wait in a line. I was told when I got there that the line had been a little longer when I got there, but it was just a lot of people in and out. I mean, people were just flowing the whole time. There were lots of people, but no one standing still. And got my vaccine and got out pretty quick.
This feels notable that that many doses are available, Destin, that 12,000 could happen in a single day. How might that affect Kent County's COVID response overall, having a place with that kind of bandwidth?
Well, they're certainly hoping that they can ramp up to a lot more vaccinations in the coming weeks. I mean, the day I was there was the biggest one-day vaccination they've had so far, but they're actually hoping to have even bigger days coming up. They say they have a capacity to do up to 20,000 doses in a single day at that site in downtown Grand Rapids. So if you start hitting those numbers every day, I think it would have a big effect. I will say that not everyone who shows up at that site is from Kent County specifically, but for the broader region, we are definitely seeing a turning point in the number of vaccines that are available, and more people are becoming eligible. And you're just hearing more and more that people, if you want a vaccine, it's still a bit confusing to navigate which system and where and how to schedule and all that. But the vaccines are out there, so we could really begin to see those results.
Sarah, I know that Detroit's public health operation recently opened its doors to all comers age 16 and up. Would you say there's been a notable change in traffic?
Well, I just want to make the distinction, first of all, that Ford Field is sort of a joint operation between FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and the state. So the city of Detroit is not directly involved in running Ford Field. But I think, that's a pretty recent adjustment that they opened up eligibility to everyone. It does seem like we're at this tipping point where the supply is really ramping up to meet demand. And then at some point, the issue is just going to be getting people who have perhaps been late or hesitant to get the vaccine on board.
At the same time, Sarah, I know you've also reported within the past week on the state's infection rate going way up. Can you bring us up to speed on what you learned?
We're looking now, I just checked the latest positivity rate numbers for yesterday for the entire state, and they was at 15%. And if you look at certain pockets around the state, and here I'm particularly thinking in Southeast Michigan of places like Macomb and St. Clair counties, we're talking positivity rates north of 20 and 30%. So we're pretty much back to territory where we were during the fall-winter surge. I mean, in some spots, maybe even worse. And I think we're starting to see that reflected in hospitalizations and also in schools and things like that. I mean, things are pretty different now because very few restrictions are left. So we're it really does seem like this race, to get enough folks vaccinated before we really enter a third or fourth surge, however you want to call it. I mean, in some places, it looks like we're already there.
Dustin, those places that Sarah mentioned are a little bit more on the eastern side of the state. What's going on with COVID rates in West Michigan these days?
Well, what we're seeing is perhaps not as dramatic as what's happening in Southeast Michigan, but that doesn't make it good on the west side of the state. So for anyone who lives on the west side of the state, we don't have any counties yet where the positivity rate is above 20%, the test positivity rate's above 20%. But we do have several counties where the test positivity is above 10% and climbing, and that's not good. And hospital numbers are also continuing to climb out here in West Michigan. Just in the past week, Spectrum Health, which is the biggest hospital system in West Michigan, went from having just 79 inpatient COVID patients to now more than 130. What's really alarming to me about that is we're also seeing ICU numbers start to climb. And, for me, I had a hope that as we saw, especially people in the older age category, 65 and up, get vaccinated, that, perhaps people would still get COVID in Michigan, but we wouldn't see as many people ending up with these very severe, severe cases in the ICU.
Sarah, what are state health officials saying about this spike?
Well, it seems very much like they're trying to tread a very fine line here between warning people to keep doing the sort of taking the usual precautions of, social distancing as much as you can, obviously wearing a mask, just doing the sorts of things that we are all supposed to be doing all along, and then saying so far that, we're not really going to pull back too much in any of the restrictions that we have. It seems like they've sort of made a bet on the fact that with vaccinations increasing as much as they are, that we're going to stave off sort of the worst effects of this surge. And just to be clear, it's possible that may be the case. It's notable that we've seen so many fewer cases coming out of long-term care facilities, and the hospital numbers for older folks above 60 or so, while they are rising so much less than what they are in the younger age groups. It's kind of a risky bet, right? Like, we don't know, especially with these new variants circulating, we it's all very unknown in terms of how bad things could get again. So they're walking a very fine line there, I think.
Have either of you heard anyone, either county health officials or anyone at the state level, use the L word, lockdown?
I have not heard anyone use the L word myself. I don't know. Dustin?
Well, in West Michigan, not that word, but we did have an announcement on Monday from, again, Spectrum Health here in West Michigan, where they were putting some visitor restrictions back on for people who are visiting the hospital. Once again, they're going to be limiting the number of people who can show up. We also are going to get an update from Spectrum Health this afternoon, and I'm sure that question will be asked because the cases continue to rise, and we don't know at this point what's going to slow it down. We're all hoping the vaccines will get out there quick enough to slow it down, but I think people are sort of waiting to see right now.
Dustin, the hospitals that we've heard from throughout the pandemic have been dealing with a lot of different things related to COVID, but they've also learned a number of different things. We're seeing hospitals converting bed space when ICUs get very full. What's on your mind about how hospitals, you know, what hospitals might need to think about if the trajectory continues the way it has?
To be clear, we are still nowhere near where we were in November and December, and I haven't heard people talking about having to convert bed spaces just yet. But as you said, you know, hospitals have experience with this now, and all parts of the state they've had to live through that. One thing that I am, you know, thinking about every day, I haven't really had many conversations about this, but there are a lot of frontline healthcare workers, particularly nurses in ICUs and doctors in ICUs, who really went through a lot this fall and winter. It was a severe mental health toll on them. They lost a lot of patients. And to be in a hospital right now working after you sort of worked your way through all of that and to see the numbers rising again, I have to imagine that that's not a good feeling, and that's what I'm thinking about.
Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer in Grand Rapids. We've also been speaking with reporter Sarah Swick from the Michigan Radio Newsroom in Detroit. Sarah, Dustin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, April.
And later this hour, we will check in with officials in Kent and St. Clair counties about how vaccination efforts and the fight against a prolific virus is going where they live. Next up, we dive into the history of seafaring for Black sailors in the Great Lakes in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Black sailors made about 10% of the crews on Great Lakes ships, and they are very underrepresented in the scholarship.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. What brightens up those bleak days on the shores of the Great Lakes? To paraphrase the great Irish punk Shane McGowan, it's rum, oddities, and the lash. Between our own vibrant traditional folk scene here in the state and our maritime history, Michigan has quite a few shanties of its own to sing. We've been especially interested in the emerging information about sea shanties that were sung by Black sailors on the lakes. With us today from the Michigan History Center is curator of exhibits Jillian Reese, who's been looking into this for us. Hi, Jillian.
Hello. How are you, April?
Pretty good. When did Black sailors first begin working on the Great Lakes?
So Black sailors have been working on the Great Lakes as long as European sailors have. The first ships coming in from France and Britain, long before America was founded, working the fur trade on the Great Lakes, both free and enslaved people working on the ships.
Well, in some places, maritime jobs can be a seasonal line of work. Would that have been true for sailors on the lakes? Would they have had other jobs and other lives?
Yes, definitely. You know, the first fur traders working in the Great Lakes would have come here during the thaw, during the spring and summer. But some folks did stay in Michigan. So Michigan's first Black resident was born in Mackinac Island to two enslaved people who were there on a French merchant ship over the winter time and was then baptized at St. Anne's on Mackinac Island.
Wow. Well, what kind of ships would these sailors have been working on? What was driving the industry at that point?
at first, like I said, it would have been the fur trade. As the fur trade waned in the early 1800s, the rise of fishing, and then eventually the big boom of iron ore and copper ore mining in the UP would have brought a lot more activity to the Great Lakes, with shipping goods between places like Milwaukee, Sault Ste. Marie, and Detroit.
Were Black sailors paid on par with their colleagues?
No, they weren't, actually. They were probably paid about half of what white sailors would have been paid, although they did agitate for higher wages and often got them because, you know, it's a solitary life on a ship, and a ship is only as happy as the morale of their crew. So oftentimes we hear oral history stories of Black sailors asking for more and getting it. And they also did different work than white sailors. And you see that in the sea shanties.
I want to talk a little bit more about that. But before we do, the description of the pay rate and the kind of jobs, I guess that kind of tells us a bit about how the captains of these commercial vessels thought about their Black sailors. Do you have any other information to fill in about that?
Yeah. So, you know, when we think about stereotypes that are rooted in racism, particularly people of African descent, a lot of the stereotypes around their labor are revolving around sort of this idea that they have unending strength and constitution and stamina, that they can, you know, do the hardest jobs. And that's one of the things that drove slavery to begin with. When Europeans started settling North America and the Caribbean and South America, they brought people of African descent over because they thought that they were more suited for the back-breaking work that was required to clear forests and jungles. And so, you know, there are still, you know, hints of that today. And, you know, unfortunately, that was something that typecasted a lot of Black sailors when they were working on the ships.
Do we know, for that matter, how the sailors viewed their work? Was this the kind of thing that people did for many years, or maybe just for a while before finding other jobs?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, obviously there were probably lots of sailors that loved it and worked on ships their whole lives. But, you know, even for white sailors, usually working on a ship was a means to an end. You know, you would work on the ship usually when you were younger. It was a good way to see the world and to move around. Particularly in the United States and the upper Midwest, you could go from, you know, New York to Montreal to Detroit to Milwaukee. And you could find communities and areas that you might want to settle in eventually. And so a lot of the first Black Michiganders actually came to settle in Michigan after working on these ships, whether it was the fur trade or fishing or hauling natural resources that fueled the Industrial Revolution. They would then, you know, retire after making their money on the ship and settle in some of these larger cities that dotted the St. Lawrence waterway.
That's really interesting. You know, we've all heard so many stories of the Great Migration. I hadn't even thought about that kind of migration over the waterways into Michigan.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, when we think about the opening of the Erie Canal, what I think a lot of people, popular imagination, is thinking about, you know, the Yankees from upstate New York moving to Michigan and coming on ships through the Erie Canal. But actually, the first great migration of African people of African descent coming to Michigan was also through the Erie Canal, and they would have been coming along with the Yankees. Some of the first prominent Black Detroiters, for example, came either as passengers, but oftentimes working on these ships and then, you know, leaving their job and settling in Detroit.
So there was this degree of heightened mobility that working on ships provided to Black sailors. But is there evidence that the shipping industry provided a way to long-term economic improvement in people's lives?
Definitely. You know, a lot of the sailors, when they would retire or maybe leave the industry, would have been able to set up their own businesses. So, for example, one of Michigan's first prominent Black families, the Bongas, settled in Mackinac Island after manumission from being enslaved on a fur trading ship. And they set up a tavern in Mackinac Island. They actually built Mackinac Island's first hotel, so starting the what we know now as the tourist industry in Mackinac Island. And they became so wealthy that they ended up moving down to Detroit and were very prominent in the African-American community there. And they actually, you know, were able to marry into prominent Odawa families and became much more embedded in Michigan's fur trade that way. And there are lots of stories like this where folks were able to work on the ships and then build their own businesses afterwards. I think, though, we shouldn't overstate that, of course. You know, we Black sailors made about 10% of the crews on Great Lakes ships, and they are very underrepresented in the scholarship. Some books about the fishing industry and the merchant industry on the Great Lakes don't even talk about the experiences of these Black sailors. So we know about the more prominent names and the folks who became successful after leaving the shipping industry and leaving their life as sailors. But we really don't know a lot about the everyday people who worked on these ships.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking today with Michigan History Center's Jillian Reese about the less-known history of Black sailors on the Great Lakes. What was the relationship between Great Lakes shipping and the Underground Railroad? I hear what you're saying, that Black sailors were only this smallish percentage of sailors on the ship, maybe 10%. But did this represent an avenue to freedom if there was a willing ship's captain and folks on board who were willing to help?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to think about that 10%, though, in proportion to the number of Black people living in Michigan. I mean, it was in the 1800s, they made up a very small proportion of the overall population. You know, some estimates in the middle of the 1800s say that there were only a couple thousand Black folks living in Detroit, a city that we think about as, you know, this central place for Michigan's Black community. And so you have to think about these ships, you know, coming into harbor, and, you know, one out of every 10 people on the ship is Black. So I think that is definitely, you know, we hear 10% and that might sound like a small number, but it was overrepresented when you think about the overall population of Black Michiganders. But to your question about the Underground Railroad, you know, many ship captains who were white would have, you know, had these racist stereotypes that pigeonholed the type of labor that Black sailors could do on their ships and limited the amount of money they were willing to pay for them. But at the same time, many of these ship captains were Quakers, and Quakers were very involved in the abolitionist movement in Michigan. And so you had, you know, ships that had Black sailors present, and you had ship captains who were sympathetic to abolition, that part of their work was moving between the fluid border between Michigan and Upper Canada. And Upper Canada, of course, was the place where many freedom seekers were trying to go because they were out of reach of slave catchers. So many of these ship captains would bring on freedom seekers onto their ships and disguise them
as Black sailors. And we have traditions of folks that gained freedom, but they also gained new life skills. Many of them would actually be working on the ships, making money while they were waiting for their passage. So it provided an opportunity. And, you know, I think we don't know a lot about this experience. We know that there were abolitionists who ran ships and owned ships. But we do know that many folks went across the Great Lakes to Canada to eventual freedom.
Well, we know that sailors certainly find a way to pass the day, and Black sailors at the height of Great Lakes shipping were no different. Will you tell us a little bit more about the sea shanties that you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, so in the 1930s and 1960s, some historians started collecting the oral traditions of Great Lakes sailors. And there is a great repository of this folk history at the University of Michigan. And one of the things that they collected were these folk songs, these sea shanties. And like you said, this was a way to pass time. You know, you don't have to be a great singer to sing a sea shanty, but it was also a labor song. It was something that was meant to keep time when you were working on a ship. And so different activities would have different sea shanties. So there would be sea shanties when you're working on deck. There would be sea shanties for cleaning. There would just, you know, be different ones. And so these historians started recording them. Some of the sea shanties that they recorded were specific to the labor that Black sailors did on the ships. You know, I talked about how there is very little in the sort of traditional scholarship about sailors' lives on the Great Lakes, about Black sailors. But these sea shanties, because they're so rooted in the day-to-day operations of the ships, actually give us a great view into what their experiences were.
So how were these songs preserved? What did researchers in the 30s and the 60s have to go on?
Historians would go out and talk to these sailors, and they would either get recordings of the sea shanties or they would just write down the lyrics. Many sea shanties kind of follow the same tempo and beat. That's basically, you know, how we know about these songs, is that they were passed down through generations of sailors.
I know you're not a musicologist, Jillian, but could you give us an example of the kind of variation in lyrics that you find in the shanties that were sung by Black sailors?
Yeah, one of the more prominent, or I should say well-known, shanties that were sung by Black sailors was one called The Ward Lined. And it was a shanty that was sung by sailors working on ships owned by Eber Ward, who was a owner of merchant ships, and he himself was involved in the Underground Railroad and in abolition. So we know that his ships were part of this, and Eber actually, a bounty was put on his head because he was so involved in moving freedom seekers from the United States to Canada. So this song is about the hauling that Black sailors would do. And so I said before that Black sailors and white sailors would have different jobs on ships. And so white sailors were usually involved in the actual ship sailing, and Black sailors were the folks who were hauling the cargo on and off the ship when they got to port. So the sea shanty, which is quite long, it's a number of lines, actually goes through that whole process. One of the first lines in the song is, "Oh, the mate, he says no work on the ship, just lay around and enjoy the trip." And that was the time that they would be sailing. Since Black sailors weren't involved a lot of time in the actual sailing of the ship, they would be able to rest during that time.
Oh, the mate, he says no work on the ship. But tell me,
who's on the way, boys? Who's on the way?
Just lay around and enjoy the trip. But tell me,
where you going?
Oh, the mate, he says one trip up the lake. But tell me,
who's on the way, boys? Who's
Jillian,
on the way?
If someone's ears are perking up right now, where can we learn more about the Great Lakes Black Sailors and their sea shanties?
So we are doing research on it right now at the Michigan History Center, but you can also find songs like The Ward Line on YouTube. Folks have recorded them and they are available there.
Jillian Reese is curator of exhibits at the Michigan History Center. Jillian, thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks.
What she'll do? Tell me where you go. Lake Superior is colder than ice. So tell me
who's on the way, boys? Who's on the way?
Fall in just once and freeze all your life. So tell me
where you go.
Lake Superior is big and rough. So tell me
who's on the way, boys? Who's on the way?
And for this holler, one trip's enough. So tell me
where you go.
Next up, health officials in two of Michigan's COVID hotspots tell us what's going on in their communities.
Unfortunately, I hate to say we need people to be concerned, but we need people to be concerned.
We believe that we can achieve herd immunity through the pace that we're on. We want to see more, of course.
The question is whether that will be fast enough to outpace the new outbreaks. Stay with us.
William H. Stevens is a lying round the bend. To tell me
who's on the way, boys? Who's on the way?
And all she's doing is a killing good men. To tell me
where you go.
Now I'm a going back to Detroit. To tell me
who's on the way, boys? Who's on the way? And no more
working both. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. As we heard earlier in the hour, Michigan's COVID case count has increased in ways that are deeply concerning to some public health officials. At the same time, the availability of COVID vaccine doses is also undergoing a spike. Adam London is health officer for Kent County, where Grand Rapids is located, and he joins us now. Adam, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks, April. Glad to be here.
The official number I see from yesterday's vaccination efforts is 12,534. That's impressive.
It is. We're really proud of that. This is the work of a tremendous collaboration between Kent County, Spectrum Health, Mercy Health. We've had volunteers. We've had air men and women and troops from the Michigan National Guard helping in this effort. It has really been a team effort. And we're feeling very good about our ability to move a lot of people in a very low-risk way through this enormous space and to move a lot of vaccine quickly. And that's what we need right now, considering where we stand with the numbers, both of new cases and of increasing vaccine availability.
Where does that number, 12,000 in one day, where does that put you in terms of the national landscape of mass vaccination locations?
That's a great question. You know, we know that we can actually move closer to 20,000 or more through this site. Now, we have seen estimates from other large vaccines in the country at Dodger Stadium and Yankee Stadium and other venues that are right in that same ballpark as well. Many of those sites are built on the drive-through structure, which actually we think is far less efficient for moving people quickly and also provides some safety concerns when you have people who just received a vaccine behind the wheel of a vehicle. So we think this is a safer approach, and we also think that it's a more efficient approach in moving people safely and getting those large numbers.
Adam, you mentioned the number of partners that it took to make this happen at the DeVos Center. That's a lot of coordination. How sustainable do you think this is over the months of the spring, maybe into the summer?
Yeah, so I'm very thankful that we started early. We opened this site in the last week of January, and that was only after many weeks of planning with these partners. And you're right, it's been a lot of work, a lot of coordination. In those early days, it was a struggle for us just to do 2,000 or 3,000 persons per day. And now we're 12,000 and can do more than that. We are at a spot now where we're envisioning, based on the vaccine projections that we're hearing, of doing the lion's share of our work over the course of the next 3 months. And we really expect that by June 30th, we'll be out of this massive clinic at DeVos Place and hopefully phasing into what I call phase forever, which is turning vaccine over to pharmacies, provider offices, local health departments, so that's available in the same way that the flu shot and other vaccines are readily available.
Mm-hmm. Does the planning for that stage, does that, do you think you'll have to get to that 20,000 capacity mark? I mean, do you need to get a little bit bigger in order to stay on track?
I don't think so. You know, I think with where we're at now, we're on pace for those numbers to get to herd immunity. Right now, we have a little over 30% of Kent County residents having received at least one dose of vaccine, and 20% are fully vaccinated. And that's been accomplished through the course of the past 2 months with a very scarce vaccine supply. Again, we were averaging 2,000 or 3,000 appointments a day for much of that time. And now we're at a point where we're seeing, 10,000, 12,000 appointments a day. We believe that we can achieve herd immunity through the pace that we're on. We want to see more, of course, and it would help us greatly if we had more of the single dose vaccines like Johnson & Johnson, which reduces the amount of work on our part by half.
The tipping point that you mentioned in June that you're trying to plan for, is that a point at which you would anticipate supply might actually exceed demand in the state?
I believe so. Yeah, I think that we have heard, and our studies have shown, that about 60 to 70% of the population is willing to get the vaccine right now. They're ready. They're confident. It's safe. It's effective. And we believe that we can certainly get to that population in the next couple of months. At that point, we know that we've got about 10 to 15% of the population that just is opposed, almost dogmatically opposed to vaccine. And they're probably not going to be persuaded, regardless of how safe and effective it is. And so we've got about 20 to 25% of the population that is our target right now. They're the fence sitters. They're the ones that they're open-minded to the vaccine, but they need to see and they need to hear about the experiences of others. And that's why it's so important for us right now to have diverse voices speaking to the community, talking about their positive experience with the vaccine, and talking about this reality that what we're seeing is it is safe, it is effective. That population that has received the most vaccine, the 65 and older group, we're seeing that group as the only group right now that is seeing their COVID cases flatten and decline. All other groups, which have received far less vaccine to this point, are seeing pretty dramatic case increases at this moment. But that group that has the most vaccine, it strongly correlates to lower case numbers. And that's the story that we need, those hesitant vaccine-minded people to hear that. And we really need them to join us if we're going to get to herd immunity. And we're going to get to these numbers by the end of June.
What's going on right now in Kent County with respect to new COVID infection rates?
Yeah, so we have seen our positivity rate increase from about 4% several weeks ago, upwards of about 10% as of yesterday. That's pretty concerning for us. We had new cases of about 67 to 70 per day a month ago to over 200 per day now. Our hospitalizations have increased, where we were at about 30 or 40 hospitalized individuals in Kent County to about 70 hospitalized persons, including 10 in ICU. And we are also seeing that this is starting to affect some younger persons. In more severe ways, we have, I think, 4 or 5 children at the Children's Hospital. We're hearing from physicians that they're seeing that some of these people in their 20s and 30s have very low oxygen saturation and are more serious than some of the cases that were observed prior to this. So with all the variants out there, we are concerned about that. We do think that this is dangerous for all age groups. This is severe across our population. All people who aren't vaccinated should consider themselves vulnerable and need to take this seriously.
All the good news about vaccination, I feel like it's gotten a lot of us feeling almost giddy. But at the same time, this spike is happening in infections. Would you be in favor of the state tightening up some restrictions again?
Well, what I'm most in favor of, April, is the people of the community embracing the things that we already know are effective at slowing the spread of this. I hope that we don't have to get to a spot where there are further restrictions, because we're also gravely concerned about the public health impacts that have happened through damage to the economy, mental health, and all these other effects. And we think that there's going to be a crater from COVID-19 that we're dealing with in public health for years to come. And so I hope that we can see our economy come back to health and to be improved, at the same time that we're seeing people embrace those smart things, the wearing of facial coverings, avoiding those social gatherings, hand hygiene, and getting vaccinated as soon as possible. If we do those things, I do believe that we can continue to see businesses and different event types reopen. I think the weather is trending in our favor. We've seen this before as well. So I think we're on a positive path. We just, we need people to adhere to that discipline for a little while longer. I'm seeing the same thing that you're referencing, and that it seems as though there is this, of course, this sense of exhaustion with COVID and fatigue with COVID, but also the sense that the vaccine's here, we've got this solved, it's not a problem any longer. And I can tell you, the hospitals know it's a problem with the cases that we're seeing, and our epidemiologists and case investigators, they are really overwhelmed with a lot of work right now.
Adam, what's the situation in Kent County schools right now? Have there been many outbreaks traced back to schools or school activities?
There have been. Yeah, and we've seen an increase of that here lately, especially with some school sports and different events. One thing that we are concerned about is we're hearing more and more of young people in particular having COVID parties. And, they're concerned about trying to get through a sports season or having an event, and they are incorrectly thinking that if they're all exposed to it and all get it now, kind of like the chicken pox parties of decades bygone, that they can, remove that as a concern. And that is just really unwise thinking. This is not the type of virus that we should be treating so flippantly.
Adam London is health officer for Kent County. Adam, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, April. Have a great day.
If you were to look at a heat map of COVID infections in Michigan right now, West Michigan is definitely pulsing. St. Clair County is glowing red, and it's radiating up into the thumb. Over the last 2 weeks, average test positivity rate in the area has risen to nearly double the statewide average, and the county's hospitalization rate is at the moment the highest in the state. With us to shed light on what's happening is Dr. Annette Mercatant, medical health officer for the St. Clair County Health Department. Dr. Mercatant, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, April.
Will you tell us, when did you start to realize that something was going on in case rates?
Well, a couple weeks ago, we were watching the school rates very closely. We had a lot of outbreaks in sports teams and a lot of difficulty actually tracing these individuals. Many of them were not reporting. They weren't quarantining. So we were working very closely with our school systems. And it was the school systems that started telling us that they were then noticing a transition from student athletes to students within the building, the academic students. And quite honestly, it was their astute observations that really helped us kind of facilitate the pauses. But by then, we were accelerating. The thing I think is of note is that a lot of people aren't testing and really weren't doing the things they were supposed to do. They wanted it to be over. And I think that really kind of pushed us into this red zone a little precipitously.
I'm sure that's true all over Michigan on both points. We know that the COVID B117 variant is more contagious. Do you have any way of knowing whether the new cases are because of that?
Well, I can tell you that we're getting reports from our state genetic sequencing facility every day. I believe today we were up to 31 confirmed cases in our little county. It certainly feels different to those of us who have been kind of walking this walk for the last year. The cases seem to really be accelerating at a rate that didn't seem the same back in November. And there's many of the cases that are connected that have the B117 variant confirmed. So Is it the sole reason we're accelerating so high? I can't really say, but I do think it's a component.
Winter was really tough for a lot of people, and it's not hard to understand how patience is running short right now, and the weather is getting nicer. What are you advising to citizens in St. Clair County right now? How are you making the case to them that they do need to continue to curb their normal activities?
Yeah, they need to go back because, as we mentioned, people were feeling a little bit more free with doing things. Some of our restaurants are voluntarily going back to carry out only. We have put out a local press release that is encouraging people to work remotely whenever possible. So we're really encouraging people, unfortunately, to kind of go back to that, you know, find your pod. Ideally find a pod that's been vaccinated and really keep yourself away from large groups and multiple gatherings. And that's the message. We really don't have any new tools, right? We have other than the additional vaccine, and we're really trying to focus on getting vaccine into as many arms as possible over the next week or two, really trying to expand our capacity.
I've heard some people suggest that right now it's just going to be so hard to get people to conform to public health recommendations that Michigan's in a place of just needing to race to get the vaccine to try to get as many people inoculated as possible. Do you think that that's accurate? Do you think we'll see rates continue to increase otherwise?
I think we need to use every tool in our toolbox. I don't think we can afford to disregard any of them, but I do agree that vaccinating as quickly as possible is probably our brightest hope. And I can also say that this spike has gotten people's attention, and it's possible that maybe when people see that COVID's not going away and that you can't just get over one side of a peak and pretend it's gone, Everybody I know knows somebody who's got COVID right now. I think we're getting to that place where the disease is common enough and there's enough people who are ill enough to make people a little bit more concerned, which unfortunately, I hate to say we need people to be concerned, but we need people to be concerned. And I think that's happening organically.
Do you think the state's going to have to consider retightening restrictions?
Yeah, I do, to be honest with you. It depends on how many people get sick and hospitalized, but we really can't afford our hospitals to become overwhelmed. When you think about our healthcare system and how fragile it is to begin with and how many times now they've had to do this, a lot more people suffer when our hospital and our healthcare system is frayed. And I think when we look at that situation, we're not going to have any choice but to try and do more.
So much has changed for local health departments during the pandemic. And I know that getting involved in mass vaccination has been a different kind of lift. How is all this affecting your department's day-to-day work?
You know, public health workers, in my mind, are unsung heroes. I'm sure you've heard that. I have absolutely amazing staff, and I can't say enough about them. But with that said, we're all really tired. We're all really tired. And, you know, it's not like we can just go home at the end of the day. Emails keep coming in. Calls keep coming in. Every time we have a problem, it's kind of we're it, right? You know, how many times do you reach out and try and talk to the health officer of a local health department, and now you're doing it all the time? It's challenging to keep our staff not feeling overwhelmed because their skills are the core. They're the infrastructure that we need to keep moving. We're trying. We're doing our best. We're trying to stagger schedules and be able to be flexible. But, you know, when you have to start setting up large clinics on the weekends and people have already put in long hours during the week, it becomes a real challenge. So we have to get creative at this point, and we're hoping that we can balance that work-rest component so everybody can survive.
Dr. Annette Mercatant is medical health officer for St. Clair County's Health Department. Dr. Mercatant, thank you for talking with us, and thank you so much for the work that you and your staff are doing.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for the call.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time.